for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Hugo Chavez supporters in Venezuela are mourning his death, especially the nation's poor. They've been the recipients of generous economic benefits. But a power struggle is likely to emerge over just who his successor will be. Joining me to talk about the uncertainty in Venezuela and the implications for the region and the U.S., Tom Jelton of NPR, Jeff Thale of the Washington Office on Latin America, and joining us by phone from New York, Moises Naim. He's with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Do call us 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Jeff. And good morning, Moises.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi. Thanks for inviting me.
Good to have you all with us. Tom Jelton, some in Venezuela are deeply mourning Chavez, but not everybody. What is the feeling?
I think that that reaction shows how polarized Venezuela has become under the leadership of Hugo Chavez. He was a very polarizing president. I mean, he advocated the interests of the poor and working classes in Venezuela and directed a lot of Venezuela's oil wealth to that sector of society. But in doing so, he alienated the professional and, to some extent, the middle class and the educated classes. And his rhetoric was also very polarizing because he tended to demonize those who were not on his side. Well, the bourgeoisie, as he called it, in Venezuela, but of course also the United States and those outside powers that he saw as being opposed to his rule.
Even the Vatican.
Even, I didn't know that.
Even the Vatican, even Catholics, he really talked negatively about them as being traitors in long dresses.
In spite of that, and I certainly take that, he did consider himself a Christian. And, you know, in his sort of final pronouncements and some of the final statements from his bedside, you know, he was saying, I put all my faith in Christ, etc. But clearly he believed in kind of a church of his own design.
Indeed. Jeff Thale.
Yeah, just a quick comment. I think it's really clear that Chavez was a polarizing figure and that he used polarizing rhetoric to advance his political career. And so he said things about the church. He said things about King Juan Carlos, all that sort of thing. At the same time, I think part of that is a political style which was tremendously appealing to the poor and kind of the majorities Chavez came to represent. And his sort of populist style really worked for him domestically.
Moises Naim, you're there in New York. How is the snow?
Yes, well, it hasn't arrived as hard as it is, I understand, in Washington, but very cold.
It's pretty bad here. Tell us your impressions of what's likely going on in Venezuela now.
There's going to be an outpour of popular emotion and support and mourning for the president. This was a beloved president by an important segment of the country, but it is equally disliked and opposed by another segment of the country. As Tom was saying before, Chavez thrived on the polarization and divisiveness of its actions, his policies, its behavior. So this is a very divided country. Its legacy is not one this is not a country that is better off 14 years after his rule, 14 years in which he had practically a tsunami of money coming from oil exports and indebtedness. This is a country that has one of the highest murder rates in the world. And there is no doubt that a lot of that money went to help the poor through subsidies and handouts. But we don't have a stronger economic structure that we had 14 years ago, and we don't have a stronger democracy that we had 14 years ago. I say we because, as you know, I'm Venezuelan.
And we should point out, you served as Venezuela's Minister of Trade and Industry in the early 90s and as Director of Venezuela's Central Bank. What happened, Moises?
Well, this was a country that, what happened essentially was that oil prices went down drastically and created a crisis that, not unlike the one we're seeing elsewhere in Europe these days and even the United States, a country that was very, very highly indebted, that thought could live off oil forever and did not do well in managing its economy. And then when the show stopped, when the money stopped coming in because the oil prices plummeted, it was a need to undertake a whole series of adjustments and restructurings and an austerity program, not unlike the one we are seeing in many countries in Europe these days. And, of course, that was a great opportunity for President Chavez, or then Lieutenant Colonel Chavez, who staged a military coup against the democratically elected government. And then he won an election. He went to jail, he was pardoned, and then he went out and he won an election very legitimately by appealing to the sentiments of rage, revenge, frustration, and hope for a change that were widespread in the country for justified reasons.
Moises Naim, he's senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And we do welcome your calls, 800-433-8850. This is an interesting email right here and now. As a U.S. citizen, why should I be interested in the death of Hugo Chavez? Jeff?
Sure. I think there are two really different but important questions here. One has to do with kind of a direct national interest of the United States, which is Venezuela is our fourth largest oil supplier and has been for all of the ups and downs and all through the Chavez government. So we have a real interest in ensuring that that flow is stable and that we have enough diplomatic and political relations for that to continue, I think. That's one. Two, I think we have a set of values and interests in Venezuela, in as we do in all of the region, in terms of both democracy and social justice. And I think the Chavez regime, the Chavez government, has left a very mixed legacy on both those issues.
But, Tom, how is it that Hugo Chavez became such an outspoken critic of the U.S., and why?
Well, as Jeff mentioned earlier, this is a kind of rhetoric that I think sells well in Latin America. I mean, the unfortunate truth is that the United States has not had a glorious record in Latin America. It's been associated with some pretty unsavory governments. It has not, I think it's fair to say, has not always advocated the interests of the working class populations in Latin America. So there is, I think, a historic resentment of U.S. power, U.S. economic power, U.S. political power, and Chavez was able to tap into that. Now, not only tap into it, but sort of fan it, exploit it, enlarge it, and really sort of put it to kind of nefarious political use.
And Moises, there is currently an interim president in place. What's the process going forward?
According to the Constitution, Diane, today the president of the National Assembly, a man by the name Diosdado Cabello, who was one of the people that was with Chavez when he staged the coup, is a former military person. He should be now the president of the country. And the Constitution also says that elections ought to be called in 30 days. They have not yet made clear what the plans are, but that's what that's the guidelines set by the Constitution.
Jeff,
just a quick comment there. I think that's right. That I think it's the executive vice president who will hold the interim office. But in any case, they need to hold elections within 30 days. I think the likelihood is that they will do so, and that the current vice president Nicolas Maduro will run against Enrique Capriles, who ran last year and lost narrowly.
Tom.
interesting little discrepancy here between Moises and Jeff on who should be the acting president.
No. Let me clarify what the actual situation is. The executive vice president of the country is Nicolas Maduro, who President Chavez appointed as the acting president. But that is only if the president was still alive and still in the president. The Constitution says that when that ceases to be the case, then the person that ought to be fulfilling the position of president is the president of the National Assembly.
Huh.
So in theory, today or whenever, very soon, Nicolás Maduro should step down and hand over the presidency to Diosdado Cabello, who then is obliged by the Constitution to call election in 30 days.
The problem here is that Moises is citing the Constitution, and in any country, the arbiter of what's constitutional or not is the court system. And the court system has not always, and I think, Moises, you would agree with me in this, the court system has not always acted with independence in Venezuela. And given that Chavez designated Maduro as his vice president, we have so far, correct me if I'm wrong, Moises, we have so far seen the Supreme Court in Venezuela sort of deferring to the political leadership. So whether they will uphold, which I think is the correct interpretation of the Constitution as you lay it out, whether they will uphold that, I think, is an open question.
That's right, Tom. And what we have seen throughout the years is that the judicial system was not independent. It was just an appendix of the government, of President Chavez, in a very personal way. He directed them on what to decide and how and when. And also the Electoral Council, the main electoral arbiter of the country, is also clearly an appendix.
All right. Moises Naim, he's chief international columnist for El País. Short break here. We'll be right back. And welcome back. We're talking about the death yesterday of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez at the age of 58. He has been ill for quite some time. He has gone back and forth to Cuba for treatment. And now, yesterday, the news came of his death. Here in the studio with me, Jeff Thayil. He's program director of the Washington Office on Latin America. Tom Gelton, NPR national security correspondent. And Moises Naim joins us from New York. He served as Venezuela's Minister of Trade and Industry in the early 1990s. He was also director of Venezuela's Central Bank. He is the author of a brand new book titled The End of Power, From Boardrooms to Battlefields and Churches to States, Why Being in Charge Isn't What It Used to Be. And that's certainly the case in this situation. How will Cuba, Tom Gelton, be affected by Hugo Chavez's death?
You know, Diane, in the early 1990s, Cuba went through a very difficult period as it had to adjust to the loss of huge amounts, billions of dollars a year in subsidies from the Soviet Union. And that initiated a period of very deep suffering in Cuba. It was called the special period. Many people saw their incomes and their livelihoods threatened. You had 35,000 people take to the rafts to flee Cuba. It was the most difficult period Cuba had gone through since the revolution. Now, theoretically, we're facing sort of a comparable situation because Cuba has really benefited the subsidies that it has received from Venezuela in terms of in the form of oil have been absolutely key to Cuba sort of maintaining itself economically. Now, Maduro, the man who Chavez designated as his successor, is considered to be close to the Cuban leadership. I don't think we can jump to any conclusion that that supply of subsidized oil is going to be threatened now that Chavez is gone. But it is an expensive, it is a drain on the Venezuelan economy. And to the extent that Maduro in the future runs into political problems, he may be tempted to divert some of that oil wealth that he is sharing with Cuba back to Venezuela to sort of shore himself up at home. So I think in the medium and long term, I think the Cubans should be concerned about losing that very important source of subsidy.
Jeff Thayil.
Yeah, just following on that, the big virtue, the big advantage for the Cubans of the deal they have with Venezuela right now is that they pay for the oil they get with medical services. So it's bartered. They don't have to produce hard currency payments. And that's a huge benefit for them in terms of their economic inputs and outputs. If that were to change in the short term, that would be a real challenge for them economically. I think Tom's right that assuming Maduro wins the upcoming elections, which the polls suggest he will, he's not going to cut that oil off or change that relationship in the near term. I mean, he's viewed as close to the Cubans and he's a trade union activist and has a long history there. I think Tom's right. In the midterm, Venezuela will face economic problems of its own and budget problems of its own, and it will have to relook at that. And if I were the Cubans, I would be thinking about how I diversify my oil resources.
And Moises, can you talk about Venezuela's economic outlook for the middle class, not for the poor who have benefited by Chavez's largesse, but what about the middle class? They are sort of angry.
Yes, and let me, Diane, if I might, I just give just a second about Cuba.
Sure.
The importance of Cuba in this story is very important, is very opaque, is not well known, and it's immense. And it's, in fact, a lot of what's going on in terms of the transition is being staged and managed by Cuba, by its intelligence services. And, again, I want to stress that that's a story that is much, much more important and large than what we now know. But over time, it will become known as one of the big surprises about how a small bankrupt island with an ideology that was rejected around the world came to dominate and have such an influence in one of the world's largest oil producers and displays the influence that historically was had by the United States. So that's a fascinating story, and in many ways is a tragic story because it has to do with the erosion of democracy in Venezuela. And of course, Venezuela's support helped Cuba postpone any reforms that were necessary there. Hmm. And you were asking, Diane, about the middle class and how the poor have benefited from Chavez. Of course, the poor had massive subsidies and handouts and support and a very strong emotional connection with the government. They felt very strongly that one of them, one representing their interests, was in charge finally. And that was very, very important. But the poor are also the victims of one of the highest murder rates in the world. They are the victims of the highest inflation in the world, and certainly the highest inflation in Latin America. They are the victims of no jobs. It's very, very hard to find a job if the job is not with the government, and if you don't show great enthusiasm for El Comandante, President Chavez, and the revolution. Almost impossible to find a job if you are not a sympathizer of the government and the president. And those that are not part of that and in the middle classes that are shrinking and and declining, while in the rest of Latin America, the middle class is becoming larger. In Venezuela, the middle class is also suffering from inflation and everything else. But of course, it's also suffering from exclusion. They are not allowed to have a lot of opportunities that are normally assumed in a democracy.
There is an ongoing campaign on television headed up by Joseph Kennedy, which indicates that the Chavez government is willing to provide heating oil to the poor in this country. How did that get started? What's it all about, Tom?
Well, the Citgo, which is a gas company that a lot of Americans will recognize, is actually a subsidiary of the Venezuelan state oil company, or it's partially owned by the Venezuelan state oil company. And Chavez has directed that Citgo share some fuel oil with needy populations in the Northeast. And Joe Kennedy was instrumental in negotiating that deal, and he clearly feels it appropriate to show some gratitude for that, show some appreciation for that assistance. I think this is one more example of what you call the largesse that Hugo Chavez displayed in sort of trying to build political support around the hemisphere. It was to the United States, but it's also, of course, to Nicaragua, to Ecuador, to a lot of countries he sort of gave, and we've already mentioned Cuba. He was using his oil wealth to sort of spread his reputation around. Now, you know, you could question, I think, whether that was the best use of Venezuela's oil wealth. I mean, imagine if all of that money had instead been invested in the educational system in Venezuela, in the physical infrastructure. I mean, this has been a 10-year period of high oil prices where Chavez could have used that oil wealth to great advantage in really making Venezuela a prosperous, modern country. And instead, we see that the infrastructure in Venezuela is really deteriorated because some would argue he has squandered a lot of this money.
But was it also meant as a thumb in the eye of the U.S., Jeff?
Well, two comments. One is, yeah, clearly Venezuela, both Chavez domestically used anti-American sentiment to build his social base. There's no question about that. And it's clear that he helped build a set of political alliances through the region, partly through his largesse and partly because, you know, as Tom mentioned, there's a sort of shared sense of frustration, sort of bad history with the United States. And he used that. I don't think there's any question. I was just going to comment more generally both about what Tom said and Moises' earlier comment that I think it's clear there are a lot of serious criticisms of the Chavez era in terms of governability, in terms of the centralization of power, in terms of how oil wealth was invested. I mean, at the same time, I think it's important to emphasize he did build support from the poor majority. He won re-election three times in elections that, by and large, were seen as free and fair. And so, you know, I think it's important to see that there's a balance to this view about what's going on and what's going on in Venezuela.
And before we open the phones, Tom, I want to ask you about this Washington Post editorial, the op-ed piece on two Cuban dissidents who lost their lives in a car crash. Can you talk about that and how it could relate to Venezuela?
Well, if the death of Hugo Chavez is bad news for Cuba, the publication of this interview in the Washington Post today is sort of doubly bad news. Very briefly, Diane, Osvaldo Paya was probably Cuba's leading dissident, the most famous Cuban dissident around the world. He was, as you say, killed in a car crash along with one of his dissident colleagues in July. The official Cuban version of the accident was that he was traveling at an excessive they were passengers in a car driven by a Spaniard and a Swede who were there to sort of show solidarity.
And they were in the back seat.
The Cubans were in the back
right.
seat. The foreigners were in the front seat.
Right.
And the Cuban version was that the Spaniard, Angel Caro, Romero, who was driving the car, was going at an excessive rate of speed, lost control, hit a tree. He and the Swede were not injured, but the two Cubans were in fact killed. And in fact, under Cuban law, if you are at fault in an accident in which somebody dies, you can actually be charged with vehicular homicide, which Carlos Romero was. And he was looking at a long prison sentence. Now, the Spanish government then intervened and got Carlos Romero to be sent back to Spain, his native country. Before he left, he appeared on television saying, in fact, it was an accident and that he had no one essentially to blame but himself. But now what has happened is that the Washington Post has just published a detailed interview with him where he says that that confession was the product of, I won't say torture, but mistreatment in Cuban prisons. He was forced to say those things. He was terrified. And in fact, it was not an accident. He says he was forced off the road. He was not driving fast.
He was rammed.
He was rammed from behind by what he suspects was a Cuban state security agent.
Who had been following closely.
Who had been following them all the way from Havana. So this, if this accident, and he provides a lot of details in this interview that certainly seem persuasive and compelling. If his version of this accident is correct, essentially, it means that the Cuban State Security Service was responsible, at least indirectly, for the death of these two dissidents and that it went to great lengths to cover it up and sort of twist the story afterwards.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Arlington, Texas. Lupe, you're on the air.
Yeah, Diane. Great show, as always.
Thank you.
I wanted to bring up a point that was brought up earlier, that Chavez played to the populist idea that the U.S. was an evil empire or whatever. Some of it was substantiated in a documentary that came out years ago called The Revolution Will Be Televised, where there was an attempted coup of Chavez. He was making the allegation that the U.S. was involved, which I don't know if it was ever proven, but months after, those who tried to depose him wound up in Miami. So he might have a reason to suspect the U.S. and say that the U.S. was unfairly involved in Venezuelan politics.
All right, Moises.
That's a very controversial situation, yet. The Chavistas and the Chavez government, of course, used that to stoke animosity against the United States, and they blame the United States for that coup. There are significant research and books that show that the United States, in fact, did not play an important role. But that depends. What I have found is that people have opinions that are immune to arguments and data. So people that are convinced that the United States played a role in that will not be dissuaded, and people that are convinced that otherwise will not. So it continues to be a highly controversial, highly ideologized debate.
Jeff Thayil.
Yeah, it's certainly true. It's an ideological debate in a lot of ways, and there's no, I think, obvious evidence that the U.S. plotted a coup or anything like that. It is clear, though, that the Bush administration at the time welcomed the coup, and I think that certainly didn't help with President Chavez when he was restored to power.
All right, to Orono, Maine. Good morning, Sue.
Good morning. I have a comment. My understanding is that Chavez was influenced by liberation theology, a theology in, primarily in South America that had a lot of concern for justice, for the poor, concerns about poverty, a theology that Oscar Romero of El Salvador was also interested in. And again, my understanding is that's one of the reasons Chavez was not particularly supportive of the Roman Catholic Church, because the Vatican didn't like that theology.
Tom Gelton.
You know, that might be true. That might be true. I think, though, that when you discuss Chavez's commitment to social justice and human rights, you also have to take into account that he defended some of the worst human rights violators on the planet. I mean, he right to his dying days supported the Syrian regime, no matter how many thousands of people they killed. He supported Omar al-Bashir, who was charged with war crimes, the head of Sudan. He supported to the end Gaddafi in Libya. He supported Lukashenko in Belarus. He aligned himself with some of the most egregious characters in the world. And I think given that record, that really taints any alleged support for human rights that he may have espoused.
Jeff Thayer.
He's speechless.
The Chavez government's international alliances were primarily rhetorical. Not like they were giving money to the Syrian regime, but their rhetorical alliances are certainly, as Tom described. Liberation theology, I think, was more kind of a grassroots movement, and I guess Chavez certainly saw himself as a Christian and may well have been influenced by liberation theology. But
all right, and quick question. Could we see a second special period in Cuba if Venezuelan support is not maintained at the level we see today? Tom?
You know, I think that's a really interesting question. And on the one hand, Cuba's economic, physical infrastructure has actually deteriorated in the last 20 years. So in some ways, Cuba is more vulnerable even now than it was back then. On the other hand, Cuba has really diversified its foreign trade and aid. It's getting help from a lot of other countries. It's not as dependent on Venezuela alone as it had been on the Soviet Union.
Tom Chilton of NPR. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
The Obama administration steps up support for rebels in Syria's civil war. U.S. leverage in Syria and its role in the Middle East. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We'll go back to the phones in just a moment. First, an email from Dave in Durham, North Carolina. Someone mentioned that Chavez alienated the wealthier segments of the population in nearly every other country, and especially in the U.S. The wealthy are cared for to a degree that I would argue alienates the poor. With that in mind, what's wrong with one country prioritizing its poorest citizens? Jeff Thayer.
Sure. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I do think that that's a domestic political question, and they have to figure out their domestic political consequences, and they have to figure out how to deal with that. There's certainly people who would say that Chavez dealt with that by centralizing power and pushing back against his opposition in ways that weren't appropriate. But clearly the basic point of how you make decisions about where you direct your wealth and what kind of programs you have is a domestic political question, and the Venezuelan government made it.
Tom.
The only other point I would make is that I think that, to put it mildly, the jury is still out on whether the poor actually benefit from a system like Chavez implemented in Venezuela. I mean, oil output has dramatically declined because of mismanagement. The loss of managerial and commercial and engineering expertise has been hugely costly to Venezuela. And if you look at countries like Cuba, which Hugo Chavez held out as a model, I think you can hardly make the argument that the poorest people of Cuba are better off as a result of the kind of socialism that has been implemented there. So, you know, just saying you're in favor of the poor doesn't mean you really are benefiting them.
And to hear from Kevin and Michael, two emails really on the same subject, is it true that Chavez accumulated over $2 billion of personal wealth while running Venezuela into great national debt? Moises.
I don't know. I don't think anybody can know that. What we know is the following. That people around Chavez, family, friends, allies, have accumulated huge fortunes. The notion that Chavez was a pro-poor government and person and despised the rich is bellied by the fact that around here, Venezuela has accumulated one of the wealthiest oligarchies in the world. This is a Russia-like group of people with strong connections with the government that are essentially intermediaries in everything that is bought and sold by the government in the country and have amassed immense fortunes. And that includes notably members of his family that was quite a poor family initially, and now they have all sorts of external signals and symbols of wealth. The other point I wanted to make is the notion that the poor are all with Chavez is also valid by the results of recent elections. In the most recent elections, millions and millions of Venezuelans, almost 45% of Venezuelans, voted against Chavez. The elites in Venezuela are tiny. They are not millions. This is a very, very small group. In order for the opposition to get 45% of the vote, that means that millions of very poor people, the people that Chavez presumably favors, voted against him. And again, and this just shows that this is a highly polarized country, not between rich and poor, but between different segments of the population are cut across very different lines. But the notion that all the poor are with Chavez and all the rich are against him is not true. Many of the wealthiest people in the world today are Venezuelans that work with the Chavez government, and many of the poor are voting actively against him.
All right, to Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Jack.
Oh, yes. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Thank you very much for your show, and thank you very much to all your guests. That's first of all I wanted to say.
Thank you.
And my question is, why is it that in Latin American countries, particularly like Venezuela, Colombia, places like that, that their constitutions are liquid? They change every time there's a new president, every time there's a new leader. They have a new constitution, a new rule of law, which is entirely different from the one that was previous. And usually it's either more corrupt or less corrupt, but they're extremely different. Whereas in countries such as the United States or, say, Canada even, they're pretty much in concrete. They're very staid.
All right. Jeff Thale.
Yeah, I think there's a long history in Latin – since Latin American independence a relatively narrow governing elite has tended to has not created a strong state and institutional foundation. Certainly, Latin America kind of went a different development path, started off in a different development path than the United States.
So each leader molds the government to his or her own liking, Tom?
Constitutions are just words. You know, they're just documents, and they don't mean anything unless you have institutions, political institutions, that can really put into practice the principles that are enshrined in the Constitution. There's not necessarily any problem with these constitutions across the continent that Jack refers to, but if you don't have leadership and institutions committed to the implementation of those constitutions, they essentially become dead letters.
All right, to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Marta.
Good morning, Diane. I was just wondering, first of all, the criticism of the criticism of the Catholic clergy. I mean, compare this to the Irish. I mean, it's and to us. I mean, actually, and I was just wondering if there's something positive of this man's legacy. The news out of the musical system, El Sistema, that gave us this incredible young man, Dudamel, in Los Angeles. Is this part of something that he's given to Venezuela? I mean, this has certainly reached down into the poor population and gave them the resources that they needed to really excel.
Tom.
Well, I'm not so familiar with that. I know who she's talking about. And in fact, this support for the musical system in Venezuela was something that Chavez did believe in a lot and showered a lot of, gave a lot of state resources to. And it did flourish and it did produce some real stars.
May I, Diane, this is Moises.
Sure.
I just want to just mention that the Sistema, which is this wonderful idea that is now copied everywhere, that is using training in classical music for poor children, that has all sorts of consequences, was not started by Chavez. This is not a Chavez program. This was started by other governments during the democratic period in Venezuela. And what Chavez did at the beginning, he was rejecting everything that had been started before, and he had been cutting programs that were not his. And then he discovered that this one was really very interesting and very successful. And then that's when he started essentially giving money to it. But this was essentially a continuation of something that had already been created before.
All right. To Pete in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Moises, I'd like to ask you, the vice president blamed Chavez's cancer on enemies, on his enemies. Now, given in today's world that everybody believes in their own facts, does he actually believe that, or is he just trying to shore up his support among Chavez's supporters?
Good question, Moises.
I was surprised that it had taken them so long to get to that. Because, sorry. Apologies. The story here is that they're facing a very, very difficult situation going ahead. Vice President Maduro, who is going to run for president, will have to face very difficult and unpopular economic decisions that are unavoidable, and there will be blame on him and his government. And people will start asking, why is it that when Chavez was in government, we didn't undertake these adjustments and cuts and difficult economic measures? And so blaming others is going to become a very important facet of the strategy. It had already started a few weeks ago when they started accusing the opposition and specific leaders of the opposition, like Leopoldo López. They went after other members, deputies and others. Of the opposition, and it was just a matter of time where blaming the traditional enemies from abroad, that is the United States, was going to be part of the narrative and the way in which they're going to try to generate support for the successor to President Chavez.
Tom.
You know, Diane, I think the question of whether Nicolas Maduro really believes that or not goes to the heart of the issue, because the truth of the matter is that in November, Nicolas Maduro had a conversation with the Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs, Roberta Jacobson, in which the two of them sort of committed informally to trying to get the U.S.-Venezuelan relationship back on a better track, that there could be more cooperation to fight drug trafficking and so forth. So certainly I know from my conversations with U.S. officials, there was some feeling after that conversation that a government headed by Maduro would be more open to better relations with the United States. If that is the case, then the fact that he is now sort of outrageously blaming the United States for infecting Hugo Chavez with cancer would certainly suggest, as Moises Naim just said, that he is looking to he's doing this for political purposes.
All right, to Mario, who's in Orlando, Florida. Good morning.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is going to be just a very quick comment that I wanted to make, actually. It's two different comments. The first one is that, based on my perspective and being Venezuelan and having studied sociology for many years, I wanted to say one thing. The first thing is that, as far as Chavez being a president for the poor, I don't think that's really the case. There is, as far as the moral values of the social, of the conglomerate in my country, of the people of my country, that has been broken throughout the years. In my country, the fact that Chavez has money, that he had probably about $2 million of personal wealth, or whatever it is the amount, it wouldn't be a problem, because according to them, he deserves it. Before he came into power, there were other people that, you know, they were also corrupt. There were corruption in my country before him. The problem that we're facing as Venezuelans, and that we face once Chavez became the president of my country, voted in, it was that he actually continued to become another corrupt president.
All right, and one wonders about the dissident community that left Venezuela, came to Miami, came to Florida. How large is that group? Do we know, Tom?
No, I don't think proportionally it's as large as the exile community that left Cuba after Fidel Castro came to power. But it is significant. As we've been discussing, he did alienate large segments of the business class and the professional class. And many Venezuelans did leave. I don't really know. Maybe Jeff
Moises does. I don't know the numbers.
All right.
Could I just make a follow-up comment on that? I mean, I think from what you've heard among the three of us and from the callers suggests both how polarizing Chavez was and how polarizing the next electoral campaign is going to be in Venezuela itself and the rhetoric we're going to hear on all sides, probably. I think just following up on Tom's comment, one of the questions is, what is the United States, what kind of approach do we take here? And I think it's really important to emphasize, however polarizing things are in Venezuela and however much there's a red flag waved in front of us about our policy and our approach, that the big thing we need to do here is say we want to see a free and fair election in which Venezuelans choose their future.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Moises, how likely is there to be a free and fair election?
The elections in Venezuela, as I said before, are supervised by a body called the National Electoral Council. And we have strong evidence that that body is completely controlled by the president, by President Chavez and the government. The person that used to be the head, the former head of that body, after one of the elections that President Chavez won, became the vice president of the country. And there is vast, vast evidence that the government uses massive amounts of public monies, public resources, government workers to support the electoral election, the outcome that it wishes. So the elections are, you know, people go and people vote, but there are profound doubts about the way the information is processed, about the list of voters and how accurate they are. But mostly there is a very prolonged and abusive use of public monies in support of the government, and also an abusive use of the media. The government has a massive control of a variety of radio stations and television stations and newspapers and the like that are completely devoted to the president and are very exclude the opposition candidates. So it's a very tilted, very skewed electoral system.
Tom.
Just one other quick question, Diane. Moises referred earlier to the Cuban presence in Venezuela. The Cubans are very deeply enmeshed, not just in the medical and the educational fields, but also in intelligence and security. And the Cubans have a real interest in seeing that there is not some sort of transition here away from the direction that Hugo Chavez was leading that country in. And I think one of the big questions is the extent to which through their intelligence presence, and there may be several thousand Cuban intelligence agents in Venezuela, whether the Cuban presence will mean some distortion of the political process because, you know, they are in position to play a pretty troublesome role.
Tom, we've gotten quite a few emails saying we are too anti-Chavez. Do you think that there is a huge segment of the population here that sees our government as looking askance at the poor in this country and therefore feeling praising of Chavez because of what he did?
No, I think that's probably true. Coming to conclusions about the nature of the Venezuelan system on the basis of your feelings about what's happening in the United States is a little bit of a stretch.
Tom Gelton, Jeff Thale, Moises Naim. We've been talking about the death yesterday of Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela. He died at age 58 of cancer. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Good to see you,
Diane. Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, and Lisa Dunn. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Natalie Yorv-Lifker answers the phones.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member station.